Hello, and welcome to this podcast focusing on biomarker-driven therapy for endometrial cancer. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent online activity, Drs. Kathleen Moore, Ritu Solani, Casey Cosgrove, and Ebony Hoskins will use cases of patients with endometrial cancer to frame their discussion of molecular profiling to select therapy. This activity is provided by PER and supported by educational grants from BioNTech, Eisai, Inc., and Merck & Co., Inc. In the first segment, the panelists discuss biomarker testing for endometrial cancer.
So this is our first patient. She's a 72-year-old Black woman, recently diagnosed with a stage 2 endometrial cancer. The histology is noted to be endometrioid. And her presenting symptom was postmenopausal bleeding that happened approximately 3 months prior to her diagnosis, and her ECOG status is 0 to 1. So some of the questions that we have up front are, which biomarker test would you prioritize for this patient? I don't know, from our, in our lab, our hospital, our biomarker testing, I think we pretty much end up testing all. And I don't know if any, when I say all, specifically looking at the MMR proteins, P53, HER2.
Are you doing HER2? Can we just do first names? I can do last names, but
yes, Ebony, please.
Okay, good, because we're in tumor board, we're all colleagues, so let's just talk. So yes. Are you doing, this is endometrioid, are you doing HER2 yes. IHC out of the gates for all endometrial, or are you just doing it for TP53 altered, if but you know, then you don't know that yet because they haven't done any of the testing. So what are you doing for IHC at MedStar?
At MedStar, they're testing all. And I don't know if it's just kind of easier on the lab because we end up going back requesting, but they're testing all up front, whether it's endometrioid or a more aggressive tissue type.
Yeah. What are you doing?
From Ohio State's perspective, you know, I think this has been a really kind of a shifting target and what we're actually doing. When we first started, I think the one molecular test that everyone should be doing is mismatch repair proficiency testing. So mismatch repair immunohistochemistry, because that's going to be important for identifying Lynch syndrome patients and also potentially understanding, benefits for immunotherapies and things like that. But the addition of things like P53 has been increasingly done because it's routinely available in our lab as an IHC test. We've had some challenges with PulE testing because we actually have to send that off because we don't have an in-house PulE test. And so we end up needing to actually request an NGS platform to test for PulE status. So we've struggled a little bit in incorporating that on a routine basis for every patient. HER2, we initially started doing it just for our carcinosarcomas and serous tumors, but it seems to me that we've been expanding it a little bit beyond that. And I think that, to Ebony's point, sometimes it's easier just to kind of do a one size fits all approach as opposed to really kind of triaging it, particularly with P53, which we have to wait for that. And then there's a lot of opportunities in that Swiss cheese to kind of miss actually getting those biomarkers done. And I'm also asking myself which biomarkers for this patient are actually going to be impactful for her care when I'm sitting across from her at the table discussing adjuvant therapy decisions. I think that this is a tough one. And I imagine quite a bit of heterogeneity across all the practices, what hospital systems are doing.
Right. I think one question that I had for you all is that, now that we're doing a molecular testing and you just mentioned Casey for PulE, we've had patients where it takes a while to get that testing back for billing purposes and have already recommended chemotherapy because it's P53 mutant. So the real question is, one, are we waiting for PulE testing, if we're sending it out, and in terms of making a decision on treatment?
In a perfect world, I would love to be able to send my preoperative biopsy for every patient off for molecular testing so that when I'm sitting across the table to make those decisions for chemotherapy, radiation, or observation, I have their pathology from their hysterectomy specimen along with their molecular profile, which we've already had a running start with ordering the preoperative testing. And there's pretty good consistency across hysterectomy molecular profiling and preoperative biopsy profiling. But where we struggle probably the most is concerns about payers. And we've had some concerns that maybe insurance wouldn't cover NGS for kind of a blanket approach in endometrial cancer, even though NCCN guidelines now are supportive of doing molecular testing on all endometrial cancer patients.
Yeah, I'll chime in too. I think we have a very similar practice where we're doing kind of universal testing with the exception of POLE and reserving that for patients who may, it would actually probably change our standard of care. So it's kind of high intermediate risk, high, grade, early stage tumors, but it is an evolving field. I also want to highlight that we also test ER/PR, and that's probably standardly done. We've been doing that for years, and it can be informative. We don't talk about it as much because it's not one of the main classifiers for endometrial cancer, but it can be very informative and helpful. And we also know it can also be prognostic, informing. So I just want to add that in.
I think that's a great point, especially since we are now adding, some newer, some endometrial cancer in addition to, say, the CDK inhibitors. So, what are you all doing if someone has what we think is a Lynch syndrome? So this patient is a Black woman, and I don't know where she's from, but presumably, if it's a patient I'm taking care of that's in an urban environment or a community, in terms of like genetics, how are you ensuring that all the patients get, whether, kind of their environment, a comprehensive testing?
We've been triaging referral for genetic testing just from a molecular perspective off of mismatch repair deficient patients that do not have hypermethylation as the explanation. With that being said, it would not shock me over the next couple of years if we kind of move to more of a universal germline testing for our endometrial cancer patients, because we've seen on several large cohort studies now where 10 plus percent of individuals in unselected endometrial cancer populations, we actually can identify pathogenic or likely pathogenic variants. Maybe those aren't, don't always explain the endometrial cancer, but can be really important for cascade testing for families, as well as individuals counseling for other cancer risk prevention strategies.
Who's doing the
Yeah.
testing and the genetics testing in your office or in your center?
Usually we refer to genetic counselors in our practice, it's not that we need them always for every nuanced portion of it or the simple part of genetic counseling, but they certainly help navigate the field of getting things approved, as well as knowing which vendors to utilize for the germline sequencing to make sure that there's a limited chance that we have any out-of-pocket expenses for patients as we're ordering some of the genetic testing.
Yeah, we do the same. We do the test. Well, I think that it's been a little bit of a mix depending on the setting. But we refer to genetics. We're all, a lot of us are in big academic centers. We have kind of easy access. But even saying that, there's not enough of them. But they do their very best to see everybody. So we end up doing the ordering of the testing and then often, and the testing will come to us. And then we'll refer with a finding. So it's kind of a mix, I would say, of referral and trying to just cover. I think what you're getting to is just make sure we're not losing the opportunity to test because an appointment is booked out or it's booked on a day that's not the day they're seeing me. And a lot of times our patients can't come multiple times for multiple
Right.
visits. So they get that sort of financial and time toxicity of getting things done. So I think it's a mix. But I sure hope that what Casey said is true, although I'm sure there's going to be downstream things that I'm not thinking of, but I really hope we get to a point of universal testing, rather than gating testing based on some other thing, because I think we're just missing a lot of opportunities to prevent in family members and do better cascade testing. But I think that's going to be a payer issue as well.
And I just want to chime in. I don't want to take too much time, but I totally agree with the universal testing. We're not there yet, but I think we will be. We also have a program where we actually it's done through genetic counseling. We have a program that they actually get a video sent to them. They watch it. They click yes. The test gets mailed to them. They swab it. They mail it back. And it's like, they can do it all from their couch. And I think it's hopefully going to enhance the rate of completion because we know there is always some drop off. So I think there's some opportunities to really kind of streamline it because there is a genetic counseling shortage. It's a little bit of, time burden for us. And, not that it's not important. It's just we have to prioritize. So I think there's lots of opportunities. So keep your eye on genetic testing and kind of make ways to kind of streamline it in your own practice.
I wanted to make sure that we take a look just kind of at the recommended biomarker panel that our audience sees here, what the recommended tests are. And we kind of already addressed like HER2, whether they're P53 aberrant or metastatic. And I think we are going to see a little bit more kind of all folks get tested. And quick question before we go on to the next one, are you all adapting the new FIGO 2023 staging into your practice?
Yeah, and I'll just make a comment on the last slide as well. To Rathu's point also about ERPR status, we know that's an important triage, particularly for the no specific molecular profile group for better outcomes. So those patients that have positive ERPR status probably have a better outcome within that very large molecular group. So I do think there is some significant benefit for early stage and advanced stage patients knowing that information. In fact, in our NRG GY32 protocol, one of the criteria for de-escalation therapy in the NSMP group is actually staining of 67% or greater for ER status. So that becomes an important triage for the NSMP group. And then I think that also just on this slide, the P53 aberrancy in HER2 testing, we certainly know there's enrichment of HER2 in that group, but we also see HER2 positivity in non-P53 mutated individuals, particularly, as we're making decisions about adding on HER2 ADCs or something where 2+ could be helpful. I think especially in a recurrent setting, that could be beneficial to be checking it regardless of that. But I just those are important. And in terms of your question about the updated staging, I personally don't even know if I've memorized all the little caveats on here. And we added to our tumor board notes, but I'm not sure if any of us are actually putting it in our clinical notes or applying it when we're discussing with our patients.
Yeah, I agree with you. I have to pull it up. I have to
Three
pull it up
times.
all I have to pull it up all the time just to remind myself. But I am trying to incorporate in my notes. Like I'll put, usually FIGO 2023 staging and then write it out, try to learn it. I do think it's gonna correlate with survival outcomes, and I think it's
For sure.
important. It's just such a change from what we were doing, and I think it's a good change, but it's annoying.
I'm gonna leave on this last note, and I sometimes we're missing the poly mutation to add into that to truly encompass the staging. But what I find in our populations, we see a significant amounts of particularly Black women that have P53 abnormal endometrial cancers, and that does make a huge change in terms of what I'm offering, and it's really I think important. So I have been adopting this the molecular state molecular testing, if you will, into our staging. So
We
yeah.
had a really interesting debate yesterday at our tumor board, actually, about a grade 3 endometrioid tumor that was P53 mutated, and we were discussing whether or not we should escalate therapy based off of that 1B grade 3. So you kind of have like the whole buffet of options, with radiation, chemo, all that kind of stuff. And so I think one thing that I've kind of advocated for, been thinking about, is if I'm going to be escalating therapy based off of P53 status, I should make sure that I don't have a concurrent poly mutation, which might suggest that P53 has less biological aggressiveness. And so I think that that's the way I've been framing it in my mind. If I'm going to escalate based off of P53, I should also know that the poly status isn't there, with a caveat that we have ongoing prospective trials for de-escalation with poly mutated tumors. And so just saying poly has great outcomes, we don't have to discuss doing anything else. I don't think we're quite there yet across the board. But certainly I tell my patients they probably have a better outcome with poly mutations.
And just to that point, Casey, that we're making, and I'm not trying to call you out, I'm just trying to call out the fact that I have to look at this every time. Is there such a thing anymore as a 1B TP53 altered tumor, or was she 2C?
Fair enough. So I think that would put you in that 2C category. And then I get really confused because I'm like, oh, stage two, my treatment plan for stage two versus stage one, historically speaking, is
Exactly.
very different. It's kind of like what we had with
Exactly.
cervical cancer a
Exactly.
couple years ago when we switched over, and we have like four different stages in the notes.
But I think this is really tricky. I'm actually relieved the three of you said you haven't memorized it because I was feeling maybe my age was inhibiting me. But this is so now now she's 2C TP53. But I don't know what to do with that, like from a treatment standpoint, because we haven't validated that as anything other than probably an individual patient level surrogate for bad prognosis. But can I fix it with chemo? Can I fix it with this? And then do I need to add in poly? And to Ebony's point, then do I have to wait for that? Because at our institution, we aren't doing next-gen sequencing, so I don't know poly. But maybe I'm going to do poly here, but then I got to wait
Right. You have to
weeks
wait.
to get that done.
But I
So
do like,
these are sort of real life challenges.
yeah, I do like Casey's strategy of saying if I'm going to escalate based on the P53, I should probably know the poly and that, we talked about this earlier in our earlier session about that dual classifier, multiple classifier. And I think this is one of those important times to look at it because we know that those patients who have those kind of high, risk looking tumors are the ones that are more likely to have poly mutations. So I think that's a really nice tidbit that you gave me.
Okay, I think we're
Yeah.
moving on,
Before we move
Casey.
on to the next one with you, can I just ask Ebony one other thing? Because you made the
Sure.
point, you were talking about your population in a where probably different than my population, where there's fewer Black women presenting, although I do have them, and them being more likely to have, not exclusively, but more likely to have TP53 altered tumors or more aggressive histotypes. Do you have a sense of, or maybe can you share with the audience a little bit more about that context and how we should be thinking about really optimizing the workup and management of our patients, our Black patients with endometrial cancer? Are there different things that we should be doing or looking at or making sure that we have knowledge of?
I mean, and again, this is probably not all database, it's just practice based, is that, even if I see a patient now that pre-op is grade one endometrial cancer, I am, I'm staging them. I even stage all the EIN because of how much cancer we're seeing in these patients. We get P53, and you would be surprised on how many P53 abnormals. As a matter of fact, I would love direction on what to do with especially the early stage serous cancer. So I think we have a lot of retrospective data that says there is a survival improvement with use of chemotherapy in this patient. So I think we're giving a lot of chemotherapy based off of the P53, and I think overall I've had pretty good outcomes with it. I also think about patients who have had, FIGO grade 3 endometrial cancer, stage 1B. At the time, let's go back 5 years, it was P53 abnormal, but we gave her vaginal brachytherapy, and then of course she recurred. So I think about that patient who maybe, had I known that there was a survival advantage, I should have given her chemo.
I really like those comments, and I feel the same way now as we're doing molecular testing. You have a head scratcher why a patient's cancer came back, and then you find a P53 mutation. You're like, oh my gosh, like we've maybe undertreated them. And I also appreciate the point when you mentioned like serous histology. So we know there's a lot of disagreement sometimes in our pathologists across high grade histologies. The rates of poly mutation in pure serous cancers are relatively low. But for grade three endometrioids and mixed histology patients, we actually see quite a bit of enrichment. So if we're in a circumstance where we're like, gosh, I'm really struggling with, I don't have a poly status or anything, for a pure serous kind of classic patient, probably poly mutations are pretty rare. The grade three endometrioids and mixed tumors, I think you're probably going to be catching more of those poly mutations where that conversation for de-escalation or maybe not as aggressive therapy could come into play. So just another thing that came up as you were chatting, but I think that's such great points. And we're learning so much now. It's like, I wish I could go back in time sometimes
Right.
and apply that earlier on.
In the next segment, the panelists discuss how they use immunotherapy to treat endometrial cancer.
Great. So I think we're moving on to immunotherapy and endometrial cancer. And I'm sure we're going to still incorporate a little bit of the molecular stuff as we kind of move along. So for this case, we have a 60-year-old patient with stage 3 endometrial cancer. The histology for endometrial cancer is endometrioid. Her molecular status identified a mismatch repair deficient tumor. She had P53 analysis, which demonstrated a wild type phenotype, and she had a negative HER2 status. We have some questions here. So the first key clinical question is, which chemo IO regimen do we select? And I guess the other part of that really is, do we add IO for this patient?
I was going to say, maybe the first question should be, what's her disease status? And I think this is it's a tough question. So, Casey, I'm going to put you on the spot. Can you just kind of let the audience know about the results of Keynote B20 or B21 results, just to put this in context, versus Ruby, NRG, GY18, and Duo-E?
Yeah, so, you know, we were in a really interesting spot where we had the Ruby data, which was, you know, a more advanced population, as well as GY18, which was more advanced in high-risk populations, that showed this benefit of immunotherapy for mismatch repair deficient, but also improvements with mismatch repair proficient. And B21, the results came out after we kind of were all jazzed up about immunotherapy and endometrial cancer. And B21 had kind of that, I would say, more bread and butter endometrial cancer population, high risk population, but stage 1 was included, stage 2, stage 3. And so I would say the bulk of my endometrial cancer high risk patients would have been this B21 population. And what was really intriguing on that was the mismatch repair proficient group didn't seem like they suggested that much benefit with the addition of immunotherapy to chemotherapy. But the mismatch repair deficient group demonstrated some benefit, although just in general, the magnitude of benefit for this better prognosis group was probably a little less impressive than the higher risk GY18 and Ruby population. And so I've incorporated that data into my practice for my stage 1, 2, and 3 patients, where I'm not using much immunotherapy for my mismatch repair proficient group, but my stage 3 endometrial cancer patients with a mismatch repair deficiency, I am considering adding immunotherapy based off of the B21 data.
Correct.
Same. So for this patient with stage 3, I would definitely add chemo IO. I think the benefit seems to be there, but you're right, it hasn't been proven. And I'm curious, do any of you guys have any preference between the different checkpoint inhibitors that are FDA approved and NCCN compendium listed?
And Casey, I really don't. I've heard people say they used dostarlimab in the setting of carcinosarcoma because they were allowed in the Ruby trial, which I appreciate, and that is true. And I like dostarlimab, but I don't know that it works better in carcinosarcoma. I think it's just how the studies were designed. So I can't think of a differentiator other than if there were a cost differentiator to my patient, that would make me pick something different. But there's not a schedule or side effect or efficacy difference to my mind. So, I mean, that's just how I sort of look at it. It's kind of like PARP inhibitor. They're all about the same.
I tend to favor the PD-1 inhibitors over the PD-L1, just personally. That's just my own bias. But I agree. I don't think that there's a big difference between those. And the data has shown the DMMR population across the board, we see really profound responses with these.
I will say a completely non-scientific consideration. In my mismatch repair proficient patients, I sometimes will use pembrolizumab, not just because NRGY18 was a little bit more powered for that, but because if I want to add on lenvatinib later on, I just feel like it's a little easier to add on than making a bunch of switches from a IO perspective. Although I've heard the alternative before, although I'm not sure there's any science behind it, where, oh, maybe I'll try a different immunotherapy with the lenvatinib and maybe that would give us some better benefit. But I agree with the whole statements. I think I kind of put them all on the same pedestal.
When you're thinking about like side effects and potential side effects for our patients, especially as things come out of clinical trials and go into the wild, you know, I do think we see lower levels of efficacy and probably more side effects because the majority of patients who are being treated we're not likely eligible for the trial for one reason or another. You know, sometimes our patients can be more ill than the patients that went on a clinical trial. So the side effects I think we're seeing across a lot of things are different, you know, when we roll it into the wild, especially ADCs. But it also, you have to put it in the context, like what the benefit is, like what makes it kind of worth it. So here is your dMMR kind of exemplar data from Ruby, but it could apply to Duo E or 018. Like the trade-off is potential cure. So, you know, even if I have somebody that's kind of ill, we can talk about that. That was one of the questions. So we'll hold on that question. But, you know, it's, you kind of are like, well, this is the risk-benefit ratio versus here, well, this is still dMMR. So yeah, that looks great. But if you look at pMMR, you know, it's better, but it's not great. And if there's risk, like if someone has lupus or somebody has terrible rheumatoid arthritis, or they're on some other immune suppressant or the other innumerable reasons that, you know, you kind of are like, eh, should I use an immune checkpoint inhibitor here? It kind of sometimes comes down to putting it into context for the individual patient and the risk benefit. And for pMMR, it's good for now, but I'm hopeful there's other things coming that may be better, that the risk benefit ratio may be more worth it. But that's kind of how I think about it too. It's
I love that kind of perspective too, because I think immunotherapy, I think, plays a clear role in endometrial cancer. We have two phase, well, not two phase three trials, but we have two phase three setting trials where you have primary, you know, in the front line where dMMR had the best benefit. You saw a signal in the pMMR, but we also have in the recurrent setting, lenvatinib and pembrolizumab, which showed a benefit over chemotherapy. But I love your thought about, you know, in pMMR, I don't think it's good enough, right? And what
Yeah.
is the role of potentially PARP inhibitors for select patients or selinexor, which is coming out? You're hearing talk about hormone therapy potentially, you know, being as a maintenance strategy. I think we need to be more intentional about our maintenance strategy, minimize toxicity in the patients who aren't really going to benefit from it. We're not quite there yet, but I don't think immunotherapy is one size fits all for pMMR. I mean, there's not a dMMR patient I wouldn't give it to unless there's a true contraindication. I think they all should be exposed at least, but we know not even all of those patients respond. So, you know,
Exactly.
there is something missing here, and we need to kind of keep exploring and looking at these options.
In the final segment, the panel discusses HER2 testing to select targeted therapy for patients with endometrial cancer.
We have a 65-year-old, stage two, uterine serous carcinoma. She had a prior treatment with platinum chemotherapy and vaginal cuff, as well as EBRT. She was P53 mutated, mismatch repair proficient. She had an IHC of 2+ for HER2, but her FISH was negative. And her HER2 at recurrence is 3+. So she actually had a little bit of a difference. So what is your next step for this patient? So she had previous platinum treatments and radiation. Doesn't look like she had any IO before. So are you going a ADC HER2 direction or IO approach for this patient?
You know what? I love the data from Pan. Am I saying the right PanDestiny2? Do we have it? Do you have that in the slides to just show kind of their response rate?
Yeah, there you go.
I think, you know, I used to think, oh, we got to give them IO up front, but gosh, look at that response rate with the plus three, 84.6%. I'm giving her T-DXd. I mean, there's hands down. Obviously, it comes with some side effects
Yeah.
profile, but I think we have a good opportunity at a great response and a durable response.
So if you had that option, because you can use that, it's on label, right? She's had chemo, even though it wasn't in the metastatic setting. She had chemo and now she's recurred, and that's on label. And I've definitely done this as well. But we have this, but the other option would be paclitaxel carboplatin. You have two other options. You could do T-DXd, you could do paclitaxel carbo IO maintenance, or you could do paclitaxel carboplatin trastuzumab maintenance.
Or we could do lenvatinib pembrolizumab.
Yeah.
Or
Because
lenvatinib
you're right. She just did
pembrolizumab
prior.
is on label.
She had received
Yes.
prior platinum therapy, so it's second line.
Well, I think
Yeah.
this is a great question because I always think about giving, you know, carboplatin again, especially with the neuropathy, and just, you know, I don't know what her physical kind of state is, but I kind of use that for later.
This is a real world patient right here, and we're having a conversation of, and I know she is eligible because it was greater than 6 months. 6 months was used in Ruby, 12 months was used in GY18 for repeating platinum with IO. So that's an option. But I can also get IO with lenvatinib, and I may be a little bit more enthusiastic for that in the recurrent setting. But I also agree that the DESTINY-PanTHER2 endometrial, particularly for the HER2/3 plus, is really exciting. Where I struggle sometimes is this is a relatively small sample size on the DESTINY trial compared to the lenvatinib pembro phase 3 randomized control trial that demonstrated that as this great next option. So I struggle with that sometimes. I don't think you make a wrong decision, to be quite frank, whether it's, in my opinion, T-DXd or pembrolizumab, understanding that carboplatin paclitaxel IO, I think, is another strategy, or adding Herceptin on, which, Katie, I think I'm probably least enthusiastic about probably Herceptin in this exact circumstance. I was also intrigued by this patient that was a HER2 2 plus and then retested. It was 3 plus. Would you retest this patient that was 2 plus?
Yes. We retest them. I think all the tumors are pretty heterogeneous and they mutate. I don't know. I think definitely if that's going to qualify her from a payer standpoint for them to cover it.
Yeah, you mean the 2+ versus 3+, because
Right.
both are
Right. Because I think it
NCCN
was
listed,
Fisher's.
but not FDA approved. And I wouldn't use trastuzumab alone, like the monoclonal antibody in this patient. So to me, the retesting isn't as relevant because once I have a positive test, I'm going to probably act on it. So, because what happens if she's HER2 1+ now?
Yeah, I had that exact problem come up as a second opinion. She was 3+, got a repeat biopsy, went down to 0 or 1+. I went to go do T-DXd, even understanding the biopsy said 0 or 1+. But then they said, oh, we're not going to cover that because of the repeat biopsy. So in my practice, if I have a biomarker that I'm able to get a drug for, I'm not necessarily trying to retest it. And if I have a patient that's negative biomarker, I'm more likely to order repeat testing to see if I can catch a biomarker that might make a new therapy eligible for a patient.
I agree with that. I tend to rebiopsy a lot too, though, Ebony. I'm kind of with you. I at the time of recurrence, I rebiopsy and test. But I don't want to disqualify somebody. But I think this will change though, don't you think though? Because I don't know, do we have the BNT323 data in here, the
I think it
BioNTech
is.
data?
Yeah, here it is. It's
Here it
here.
is. Okay. So we have this data that has been presented just a few like couple weeks ago by Bhavana Puthuri, where it's one of our larger data sets. So not putting any sort of not throwing shade at DESTINY-PanTumor tumor that was transformative for a lot of tumors, but it's only 40 patients. So this is over 100 patients now. So we're getting, and it's a similar medicine, right? Trastuzumab pemirtecan. And I was involved in the phase one, so I have COI. So I'm just saying that out loud. But I am just pointing out that the response rate was high, 1+, 2+, 3+. There was a big difference between 3+ and 1+ and 2+, but 1+ and 2+ were about the same, and they're both better than anything else I would want to use, in that setting. So right now, I wouldn't want to disqualify someone if I could use T-DXd, because I think T-DXd is probably the same. I think it works in 1+. We just haven't seen the data. But then you can see these other options here, and Sacy-Gobi is an example, but there's data from rinatabart sesutecan in which we've seen puxitatug, which is a B7H4 in endometrial with response rates in small numbers in like the 50% range. So in the future, I may want to rebiopsy because if I have a 1+, I might want to use a different topoisomerase 1 ADC. Because I'm probably going to only get benefit from one. So in the future, it may be really important for me to know if it's still 3+, but right now, I would not want to know if it's not anymore because I want to use the medicine that I have available. But I may change over time as things become or don't become available. I don't know. What do you guys think of that?
Yeah, I agree. I echo your same sentiment. I think we're going to have lots of options and figuring out which one's going to be the best strategy. But I like that we're seeing kind of activity with lower expression, and we're seeing these kind of maybe even biomarker agnostic findings, where it doesn't really matter, Rina-S being an example of that. So I think
That's
it's
true. That was the
emerging.
problem.
It,
Yeah.
you know, so I think it's going to be a little bit of an emerging target, and having therapy options. I think what you highlight is, you're seeing good response rates in these low expressors, which are better than kind of our current standard of care, or comparable with maybe len-pem. But standard chemotherapy, I think, is going to be single agent chemotherapy, I think, for endometrial cancer, is going to be a thing of the past.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on the topic, click on the link in the podcast description.